Hey there, I'm your host, Sarah Lorenzini, a rapid response nurse and educator who loves telling stories to teach critical thinking. This podcast is for nurses who want the knowledge, skills, and confidence to respond to any emergency. With almost 20 years of experience in the ER and critical care nursing, and a master's degree in nursing education, I have a lot of stories to share, and I love to nerd out and break down the pathophysiology, pharmacology, and nurses' role in emergencies. Stories bring learning to life. It is way easier to learn from and remember the stories that my colleagues and mentors have told me than anything I've read in a textbook. And that is why I made this podcast. Every episode is packed full of exactly what you need to know to handle whatever crisis that could arise on your shift. It's one thing to get the right answer on the test, but knowing how to detect when your patient is declining and what to do when your patient is crashing is what will make or break your day and might just save your patient's life. All right. Welcome back to the Rapid Response RN podcast. Today, I'm very excited because we are delving into SIADH and diabetes insipidus. This is such a heavy pathophys topic. As you know, I recently did an episode on hyponatremia, did a deep dive into it, and then uncovered SIADH and diabetes insipidus. And I was like, there is so much more to talk about. This needs its own episode. And who better to talk about it with than my buddy Nick McGowan from across the country. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Sarah. It's good to be back.
Or should I say, yeah, welcome back to the podcast. Good, welcome back. All right. So, Nick, can you just briefly introduce yourself? Tell us what you're up to these days. And how do you have any insight into SIADH and diabetes insipidus?
Yeah, brief background on my end. I've been an ICU nurse since, 2011. It's weird. That didn't used to seem that long ago. But yeah, I guess that was quite a few years ago. I've worked in different capacities from trauma, cardiac, and now for the last 9 years, I've been working in neuro ICU with neurotrauma patients. So that's really exciting. So I've certainly seen my fair share. I am fascinated by all things critical care. I love learning about how to optimize the human body when it's in a critical state. And I love teaching critical care nursing, but in like an innovative way, making it a little bit more inspiring. So, and this is actually where I think there's a gap in this area of our profession. So I earned my master's degree in nursing education in 2020, and I also launched an educational platform that helps nurses pass the CCRN certification exam. So I've been busy and it's exciting. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to this next step and this next phase in critical care nursing. It's exciting to see where our profession is going.
Yes, agreed. So if you've listened to my podcast for a while, the ads that I do for Critical Care Academy, that's this guy. This is the Nick I'm talking about, those ads. So glad to have you on the podcast, Nick. All right. So let's talk about, so you work in neurotrauma. I'm sure you've seen your fair share of cases of SIADH and diabetes insipidus. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples of what these patients look like, their labs, and like how they even developed SIADH in the first place?
So with SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, and diabetes insipidus, DI, these are disease processes that can develop after a major CNS injury, like a stroke, an intracranial hemorrhage, meningitis, brain tumors, or after like a brain surgery, like especially around the pituitary gland. This is where you may see either SIADH or diabetes insipidus. This is something that immediately that the nurse needs to be aware of. Like these are the high risks after something like that. So from an assessment standpoint, from a neurologic assessment, patients with both SIAD, SIADH, or DI, they're going to have a very similar presentation depending on the severity or how depleted they are, specifically of volume or sodium or antidiuretic hormones. So some of the non-specific symptoms you might see with these patients neurologically are nausea, vomiting, headache, confusion, lethargy, they're going to be irritable, all the way increasing severity, they may start to have seizures or be completely obtunded in the more severe cases. And so I say non-specifically is when you get a patient like in intensive care, if you get a report or you get a patient from the ED and they have any of these symptoms, you can go a variety of directions. You need to move in a certain direction. And so that's when you're going to start to think, why is my patient lethargic? Why are they irritable? You know, or okay, they're having some seizure activity. It could be a number of things. And so that's when we want to kind of focus it and narrow in. And once it's found that this patient is either in DI or SIADH, then we can move in that direction of treatment. So specifically now with DI, depends on if the patient's alert and oriented or if they're sedated or obtunded. So these patients are going to also present very thirsty, polydipsia, and they're going to be from the dehydration and they're going to have polyuria, excessive urination throughout the entire day. And sometimes it can be up to like 500 to 750 milliliters an hour. So that's going to be the other end or the difference in presentation with DI patients and SIADH. So interestingly enough, when we talk about diabetes insipidus, do you know where the term diabetes insipidus comes from? This is kind of a interesting
little... I would
love
to know. So, do tell.
So I'm into this kind of stuff. You know, as an educator, I like to narrow down on where did that term come from. I like to know the why on more things than really necessary. But so diabetes is a Greek word meaning passing through or siphon. And the Latin word for insipidus means, get this, it means tasteless or insipid. And mellitus, like diabetes mellitus in Latin, means sweet tasting. So you ask, wait, what do you mean tasting? So yes, back in like the 17th century.
Tasting, exactly.
Yeah. So back in the 17th century, physicians, they were called piss prophets. And they would actually gaze at urine. They had this whole like uroscopy wheel. And it was essentially like a medieval method, like a urinalysis that we have today. But back then, they would look and they would gaze at the urine of their patients. They'd look at the color and they would actually taste it to make these determinations or predictions on if the patient would survive. So super interesting. Glad we don't have to worry about doing that today. Yeah. And so, of course, back then, these prophets, you know, it was kind of a win-win situation for them because he actually predict if the patient would die or that the patient was going to die unless such speedy remedies were used. And so if the patient dies, well, then he's hailed as this prophetic physician and, you know, he predicted right. Or if the patient lives, then he's going to get credit for that miraculous cure. So it was a win-win. So it was really, really interesting, you know, and I always like to share that, dive into the history to see where we've come from in terms of treating people and you know, so I would like to think in the next 100 years, they're going to look back on our times and wonder the same thing, like, oh my gosh, you know what physicians back in 2020 used to do, you know? And so I'm always fascinated with that.
Okay. So diabetes insipidus, they have tasteless urine then?
So essentially, yes, diabetes insipidus, the urine would be considered tasteless. And if you look at it and you understand it from the, you know, pathophys side of it, it's very clear, it's very diluted. And so, yes, it's essentially going to be odorless and tasteless. It's going to be very dilute, almost like water.
Gotcha.
Luckily, you don't have to taste it to figure that out. You can just look at the urinalysis.
Oh, yes. I'm glad that's not part of my role as a nurse is tasting urine. I'm happy to let the lab do that investigation for me for sure. So Nick, before we dive too much further into like the assessment findings and all the labs for these patients, can you talk first about like what's actually happening at the pathophysiology level? Like syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone is such a mouthful and almost like a double negative, like antidiuretic. What is actually happening inside the pituitary, inside the kidneys that's causing these two different diagnoses?
Sure. Yeah. And I completely agree. SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone. It is a mouthful. So when I first consider antidiuretic hormone, it's important to understand what is the normal role of this in the body. So in critical care, you need to first understand how each system is supposed to work. And so once you understand how it's supposed to work, then you can better recognize and treat and evaluate the patient when that system is not working. So with regard to antidiuretic hormone, we also call this vasopressin, and this is a hormone that we make. It's formed in the hypothalamus, and it's secreted by the posterior pituitary gland when our sodium levels rise, kind of like a negative feedback loop. So this hormone stimulates the kidneys to reabsorb water and dilute our serum and bring the sodium level back to normal. So just like I think of like our thermostat in the summertime, right? So you set the thermostat at a set level. As soon as the heat rises, thermostat kicks on, triggers the air conditioning to run until it brings the temperature back down to normal, and then the air conditioner kicks off. So this is a negative feedback mechanism. So, well, in syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, something has caused this feedback loop to break. So I think when I think SIADH, I think swimming in too much water. So Remember, we talked about the causes, the CNS injuries, pituitary surgery, some drugs, even lung cancer can cause this excess release. This feedback mechanism is broken. And so now antidiuretic hormone is continually being produced and released, which makes the kidneys excessively hold on to water. So one of the problems that results then is what's called dilutional hyponatremia and water overload. So now your body's holding on to too much water. Your sodium levels are low. You're dilutionally hyponatremic. So that's essentially the mechanism of SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone.
And then on the flip side, what's going on with diabetes insipidus?
So now with diabetes insipidus, essentially the opposite is what's happening. So instead of producing too much antidiuretic hormone after a CNS injury, you can also actually produce too little antidiuretic hormone. And this is a little bit, a little bit more in depth. You're going kind of a different direction, but it's opposite. The opposite end of the spectrum from SIADH is diabetes insipidus. And this is where you can either A, produce too little antidiuretic hormone. We call this vasopressin deficiency or central diabetes insipidus, or there's a resistance to vasopressin, a vasopressin resistance, formerly called nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. So it can happen either from a central problem, meaning you're not producing enough in your hypothalamus or your pituitary gland, or your kidneys are resistant to the antidiuretic hormone that's being produced, known as nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. So what you really need to know is both of these, whether it's central or nephrogenic, there's an excessive urination. There's not enough antidiuretic hormone being produced. So therefore, your kidneys are losing massive amounts of water, up to like 500 to 750 mils per hour. So these patients are going to present obviously extremely thirsty. They're going to be dehydrated. And also there's going to be resulting hypernatremia because of their loss of water. They're very clear. And you see these patients, they have a Foley catheter sometimes, and that's just being filled up. You can't stay ahead of it in emptying it. You're emptying these things every hour or so. And it's clear water. It's not yellow. It's not concentrated. It's very clear fluid. So these patients become very dehydrated very quickly. Now, it's not the alert-oriented patients, the ones that can complain of thirst and then actually are just chasing it with water constantly. These can get scary, but the thing that from a nursing standpoint to be aware of are those patients who are obtunded, where the thirst mechanism is not intact. And so we don't know other than looking at some of the other assessments from these patients that are either obtunded or intubated, and they can't actually verbalize that they're dehydrated and that they're thirsty. So that's another side to it that's important from a nursing standpoint.
Gotcha. Okay, so in SIADH, there's too much ADH and the body's like holding on to all the water, so they get hyponatremic. But in diabetes insipidus, it's the flip side. They are peeing everything out, so much so that they would tell you they're thirsty, but if they can't tell you, you just see like massive amounts of urine being produced. Very different problems. Okay, so aside from looking at the Foley bag, what else can we do diagnostically to determine the difference between these two diagnoses?
So there's the nursing side of it, of what you're looking at, how you're assessing these patients. But then there's specific key lab values that you want to look at and you want to understand from the nursing perspective. And so there's like four or five things that you want to hone in on and you want to focus in on your nursing assessment. And key lab values. So the things that you want to look at are your serum sodium levels, your serum osmolality, your urine sodium levels, your urine osmolality, and then of course your urine output. Those are kind of the five key players or the key lab values that you want to stay on top of. And each of them have their own normal range. It's important to know from a nursing standpoint what the normal ranges are for these lab values. And then that way you can determine which way they're going. And that's how you can tell if this patient is hyperosmolar or hypervolemic, or hypernatremic, hyponatremic, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, so what would you expect for each one?
So as far as the diagnostic findings that you're gonna see, there are differences. And it's actually, you can break it down. There's like, I've created simple charts for this to be able to quickly look and reference what's gonna be high and what's gonna be low. So if you look at from an SIADH versus a diabetes insipidus standpoint, broken down very simply, the urine output with SIADH, these patients are going to be either euvolemic to moderately hypervolemic. So their urine output's going to be low. Everything's going to be essentially on the opposite side with diabetes insipidus. So in diabetes insipidus, their urine output's going to be very elevated. Like I said, it can be, you might see from 300 to 500 all the way up to 750 milliliters per hour, which is on the severe end of diabetes insipidus. You look at antidiuretic hormone on that end of SIADH, it's going to be very high. Too much antidiuretic hormone versus diabetes insipidus, it can either be low or, like I said, we find that sometimes it could be a nephrogenic cause where the kidneys are resistant to antidiuretic hormone. More importantly, or probably the most important thing that I look at, is sodium levels. What do the sodium levels look like in these patients? Because that's what affects the presentation, and that's what can be detrimental to a lot of these patients, especially with CNS injuries. So in SIADH, if you think about it, remember I mentioned swimming in too much water. It's a dilutional hyponatremia. So these patients' sodium levels are very low. We know the normal sodium levels are 135 to 145. So you can see sodium levels in the 110s to the low 120s versus in diabetes insipidus, they're going to be hypernatremic because all their volume is lost, all their water is lost. So it's going to be much more concentrated in the serum. Their sodium levels are going to be high, above 145. And another thing that it's good to know is serum osmolality. And when I think osmolality, I just think concentration. So what's the concentration, both in serum and the urine? What's it? Is it concentrated or is it dilute? So one of the ways I remember, most of us know how to, it's memorized. We know what the normal sodium levels are, 135 to 145. So for osmolality's sake, from serum osmolality, I just take sodium levels and double it. That's kind of a quick down and dirty reference range. So the normal serum osmolality in patients are 275 to 295. So anything lower than 275 is more dilute. Anything greater than 295 is more concentrated. And so if you think about that, in SIADH, you know that there is volume, not volume overload, but you're swimming in too much water. So there's a dilutional hyponatremia. So the serum osmolality is going to be low. It's going to be dilute. So you're going to see serum osmolalities less than 275, like around the 260 range. On the other end, diabetes insipidus, it's going to be more concentrated. So your serum osmolality is going to be above 295. And then similarly for urine osmolality, but the interesting thing, this range is much, much wider. And so if you just look at a stat, you know, it's essentially like, what's your urine concentration? If you take a random urine sample, the normal osmolality can range between 100 all the way up to 900. Sometimes, I don't know, you see different ranges. I see 50 to 1200. So it's a pretty wide range. And so if your urine is very concentrated, it's going to be more elevated in the 500-600 range. If you drink a lot of water and you're just peeing it out, that urine, if you took a urine osmolality, it's going to be in the lower range, like less than 100. So those are kind of the key differences for that. But it's essentially what you take that urine osmolality in consideration when you're assessing specifically these patients. And then there's other values that we can kind of look at, like urine specific gravity or urine sodium. These are all the things that the physician's going to look at to determine which direction to go. So it's important to be familiar with those.
Okay. All right. So we've got some labs back. We have our diagnosis. Your patient has SIADH or your patient has diabetes insipidus. What is the nurse's role in monitoring and caring for these patients? And then what treatment can we anticipate to bring them back to a state of homeostasis?
Yeah, no, these are great questions. So once it's determined, so we'll say, let's say the patient is determined to be an SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone. There's very specific treatment options for these patients. And it's not a lot. There's just a couple of things that you need to keep in mind. So with both SIADH and DI patients, obviously nursing assessment, close monitoring is important. And they're going to be in the intensive care unit. So from an SIADH standpoint, you need to do regular neurologic assessments with these patients, especially because a lot of times they've already come back. They already have a pre-existing or some sort of CNS injury, whether it's a stroke or intracranial hemorrhage, or they had some sort of transsphenoidal pituitary surgery. You're already doing these neural assessments. But the first thing that I think of when I've got a patient that even has had some sort of CNS injury, the first thing I'm doing is I'm looking at that Foley and I'm checking, what's the urine output?
Hey guys, I'll get back to the show in just 1 second. But before I do, I have a request. If you have ever gotten any value from this podcast and you want the show to continue to grow, to access more awesome experts in the field, and to keep providing you with more nursing knowledge and inspiration, could you take a minute to leave a rating and a review? Those reviews on Apple and Spotify go a long way in getting this podcast in the hands of more nurses and bringing new guests to the show. And they just make my day to know that my stories and nerdy patho breakdown are helping other nurses thrive, or at least survive. So if you're feeling up to it, I'd love to see a rating and review from you. Thank you so much. Now back to the show.
If that Foley bag is filled of clear yellow urine, I'm immediately moving in that direction of, oh, okay, we've got diabetes insipidus happening here. Or conversely with SIADH, I'm going to be looking at those serum osmolality levels. I'm going to be asking about what their urine output is, things like that. So from a neuro assessment, it's important to monitor very, very closely with these patients, especially because with SIADH, this is a volume excess. And so what can happen with hyponatremia is these patients can progress with cerebral edema. Their cells are swelling up. So that's very important to monitor for. Again, those non-specific neuro changes, these patients can come back lethargic, weakness, nausea, vomiting, irritability. That's from the assessment monitoring standpoint. And then the management is also with SIADH patients, you need to put these patients on a fluid restriction because they're already a little dilutional. And so giving them more fluids can actually cause more harm to them. So you need to, these patients have to have a strict fluid restriction. And then now the caveat for that is if they came back with like a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a fluid restriction can actually precipitate a vasospasm or even a cerebral infarction. And so there's kind of a caveat. You got to be really, really careful with the management of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage. But in both of these cases, fluid management is key and it's essential in SIADH patients to restrict fluids. Now, this is also important from a family standpoint in communicating with the families of these patients, because so often families can interpret fluid restriction as harm, which is, it's really important. This is where the art of nursing comes into play and how you articulate the treatment plan to the families. Listen, mom or dad, or listen, significant other, this is why we have to restrict fluids. The patients, they're always thirsty. They get extubated, their mouth, so they want oral care. They just feel thirsty. But that in this case, it's really, really important to articulate the harm that can be caused by giving patients with SIADH fluids. So then the other thing to really, really closely monitor for is their electrolyte monitoring, their sodium levels. Depending on the severity, sometimes you're doing these lab draws every 2 to 3 hours because we have to really, especially with sodium levels, you have to really, really tightly control and monitor the progression, the trends of sodium levels. So from medication standpoints, you want to give these patients hypertonic saline. Usually you're going to see this at 3% sodium. Usually it's running between 15 to 30 milliliters per hour. Now, the big thing that you need to also be careful of, and most critical care nurses understand this, is you don't want to correct sodium levels too quickly. And we know this because if you correct sodium levels too quickly, you can progress to what's called osmotic demyelination syndrome. And this is like, to me, that's like the top five worst things that you can actually have. This is where you become locked in. You are aware of everything that's occurring, but it's a permanent, irreversible brain damage to where you can't move, you can't function. And it's got to be one of the most scariest things that can happen. And we're always told or warned of osmotic demyelination syndrome if you administer sodium too quickly. So kind of the gold standard, kind of the rule is you don't want to correct sodium any more than 4 to 6 milliequivalents in a 24-hour period. So that's always something that's burned in my brain of sodium replacement with hyponatremic patients, especially the ones with CNS injuries that are in syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone. Now, you also give other medications like loop diuretics, like furosemide. You might see this prescribed as well to these patients. So that's the medication side of it. Those are the two mainstays of treating SIADH. You want to restrict fluids and you want to give them hypertonic saline at 15 to 30 milliliters an hour. And you want to closely monitor their sodium levels, making sure you're trending it and moving it in the right direction. Now, there is a caveat here, and there's some there's some debate in the literature. And so
my favorite.
Yeah. It's important to understand from a nursing standpoint now. So, and I learned this because we were in rounds one time and I listened to the attending intensivist talking to her residents about this when we had a patient in SIADH, and she corrected them. She says, no, they're not in SIADH. They are in what's called cerebral salt wasting. And so I perked up like, wait, what? What cerebral? What? So again, there's some debate about if this even exists, but it's essentially very, very similar to SIADH, except instead, as far as a treatment standpoint, instead of a fluid restriction, you're actually going to give these patients fluids. So I really can't get too in-depth into what cerebral salt wasting is considered, but it's essentially, it's not a dilutional hyponatremia. It's a true loss of both volume and sodium. So this is something that, like I said, from what I'm reading, there's debate as far as if it even exists. And so all I know is that's something that I also watch out for. So the treatment for cerebral salt wasting is essentially the same thing as the treatment for SIADH, except for you don't want to restrict fluids for cerebral salt wasting because you can actually cause more harm to these patients. So that's where it's got to get really interesting at a physician level to make those determinations on if the patient is in SIADH or if they're in cerebral salt wasting. I don't know. I'm going to stay in my lane on this one, and I'm going to trust that both of these avenues do exist. And at this point, I'm going to trust that, okay, the physician is looking into this in collaboration with the nephrologist or the endocrinologist. And if you want me to restrict fluids, you write the order, you collaborate with me and tell me why. Or if you want me to give fluids, you write the order and you tell me why, and I'm going to make sure that that happens. So it's something to be aware of from a nursing standpoint. So where SIADH is a euvolemic or mildly hypervolemic state, cerebral salt wasting is more of a volume depleted state. So that's something that, I don't know, I think is important to be aware of.
Thank you for that clarification there. So we've talked about treating SIADH. What about on the flip side? Now they have diabetes insipidus. What are the treatment options there?
Yeah. So now with diabetes insipidus, again, this is going to be kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. So with these patients, they are profusely dehydrated. They have profound polyuria. They're urinating 500 to 700 milliliters per hour, sometimes on the severe end. And so depending on if they're alert and oriented, they're awake, or if they're obtunded, depends on what you're going to do. Usually, so fluid management is key with these patients. You want to replace the lost fluids. And so if they're awake, if they're alert and oriented, they're going to be chasing it with free water on their own. So you're just going to make sure to provide that water for them or make sure that they have access to that to replace that lost volume. But if they're obtunded, you need to provide that intravenously for them. And so you're going to, in these patients, the treatment is going to be with D5 water, D5W given usually around at a max of like 500 cc's an hour, because of course you need to watch, you need to monitor blood sugars. You don't want to give them too much dextrose. So that's another part of the management from the nursing standpoint. And then in these patients, of course, educating them and the family about the importance of adequate fluid intake to prevent the dehydration. And then, of course, again, same thing, you're going to monitor closely those lab values, the electrolyte levels, especially the sodium, to detect any imbalances. And then, again, to trend which direction we're going, if they're hypo or hypernatremic. And then for diabetes insipidus, the other key treatment, in addition to fluid management or fluid replacement, is you need to replace the antidiuretic hormone. And this is normally with what's called DDAVP or desmopressin. And this, you can give this intravenously, the several different routes that you can give desmopressin, because they're either not producing it or their kidneys. Well, so if they're not producing it, you're going to replace with desmopressin. And then if they're resistant, like with nephrogenic DI, you might give thiazide diuretics, or I believe it's fludrocortisone, to also help with the renal absorption of sodium and water in that case. And then, of course, you're going to monitor the response to that. You're going to do your frequent neuro checks, same thing that you would do for SIADH. And then, of course, patient education. And then all the rest, your standard nursing care of your vital signs, monitor for blood pressure, monitor for hydration status and volume status with these patients.
Yeah. So what you're saying is this is a very busy patient. I mean, if they are peeing out a ton, and I'm also having to replace that fluid loss, I'm changing the IV fluid bag like every 2 hours, and I'm emptying the Foley bag like every hour or so. Like, this is busy. There's a lot of water that's going in and going out. So this is why these patients go to the ICU, just because there's so much nursing workload to get these patients turned around.
They're extremely busy. And then if you add other variables, like I've had patients that are very hard sticks and the visitor wants lab values, or they want labs every 2 to 3 hours, and you're just trying to find a vein. They're extremely dehydrated, so that becomes also challenging. And so, yes, you're just running, you're managing fluids, plugging in, like you said, dumping urine, adding IVs. So it's chasing fluids, but also making sure to make sure they're moving in the right direction. So very, very busy patients.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's say you're about to precept a nurse for a shift, and the patient has a diagnosis of either one, SIDH or diabetes insipidus. What are like the key takeaways that you would want this nurse to know about the difference between the two, what their role is going to be as a nurse? Like, what's this shift about to look like? What's the nurse going to be aware of to properly manage this patient? Ready, go.
Yeah, sure. So essentially, down and dirty, give the patient what they're missing. Whether it's fluids, replace the fluids. Whether they're missing sodium, replace the sodium with like 3% or sodium tablets. Or if they're missing vasopressin, you're going to give them DDAVP, you're going to give them the desmopressin. So that's kind of something that's just down and dirty, give them what they're missing and pay close attention, monitor their urine output, do your neuro checks, monitor their vital signs, especially monitor and trend those sodium levels. You have to make sure, and it depends on your facility, your protocols, if the patient's a hard stick. Sometimes you can get busy with another patient and forget. You can't forget to do those frequent sodium checks. I see it all the time. Physicians are calling me, Nick, where's my lab value? Where's that check? I ordered it 2 hours ago. I need it every 2 hours. And so I can't stress enough, make sure to stay on top of those lab draws. And then, so I have my own case of something that I learned from, and you need to make sure to, so with this, in terms of shift handoff, here's a little case study for you. Trust but verify. And I can't stress that enough. So I had a patient, I don't know, about 6 months ago, that they were hypernatremic. And it wasn't from diabetes insipidus, from what I recall, but there was a neuro injury. I can't remember specifically the injury that they had, but they were hypernatremic. And so what do we do for patients that are having hypernatremia? Sodium levels in the 150s and 60s. First thing we know to do, free water flushes, right? No problem. Well, this patient, they had an injury to where they couldn't swallow. And so they had a core track. And so, cool, even easier now. I don't have to make sure they're drinking. I just program the pump to give them these free water flushes, right? So that's what we use in my facility. We use these kangaroo pumps. So I get report on the patient and we're going down top to bottom, patient's neuro status. Here's the IV pump settings. Here's what they're getting. They're getting some volume, whatever it is, whatever settings they're on the IV pump. And then she goes, okay, from a GI standpoint, they're getting these 2 feet. And then free water flushes are, I think it was like 400 every 4 hours or something like that of free water. I was like, okay, cool. All right. So when I hear that, I'm thinking, oh, they must be hypernatremic if we're giving them frequent free water flushes. So check that box and move on, right? So, and then they're getting sodium lab draws. I think they were at like every 4 or even every 6 hours, right? So there's a lot of automation that's occurring here because there's a lot of things we have to do in the ICU when you have two different patients that are very sick. So the interesting thing was, I think it was about 3 p.m. I'm over halfway done with my shift and the attending calls me and says, hey, Nick, is your patient getting their free water flushes? And immediately I'm thinking, Yeah, of course they're getting their flushes. I got a report this morning and she showed me the pump and I saw the free water in the bag. And yeah, they're getting their free water flushes. Why, doc? And he says, well, because their sodium level keeps climbing. It keeps going up. And I thought, and immediately I kind of like freaked out. I thought, oh my gosh, that's not good, right? And so he says, well, are you sure they're getting free water? And I was like, yeah. And I was trying to think why, you know, with free water, you know it's going to bring down the sodium levels. But next thing I know, he's in the room. He's taking the bag of free water off the IV pump, dips his finger in it, and he tastes the free water that I had hanging. I'm like, so I walk in the room and I see him doing that in his residence right there. I'm like, what are you doing? So he was verifying that because we store our free water right next to our normal saline, right? The sterile saline versus the sterile water. They're stored together in the same area. So I guess he was thinking, well, maybe the nurse before filled it up with the wrong fluid, right? So he's tasting it and he's like, yeah, no, it's free water, right? Because I was thinking, oh man, that could have been a problem. So short story long, It turns out that the pump itself was never set to give the free water. I was mortified about this. I thought, oh my gosh, that was my job. I trusted the night shift nurse that they had the pump setting and was giving the free water, but I didn't verify myself on the pump that it was programmed to give that free water. So throughout the shift, the patient's sodium level was climbing. The good news was he ended up being fine. I gave him a bolus of free water and I turned it back on, apologized. So it was a good outcome. But as a critical care nurse, I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed, all the things. So take my lesson, trust, but verify your pump setting. So there's another little pearl of wisdom I can give for you about that.
That's good, Nick. And honestly, we've all done it, right? How many times have you hung the piggyback and be like, and start? And you come back in an hour, you're like, I didn't unroll the clamp. The patient just got a bolus of saline rather than the antibiotic that they need for their sepsis. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's happened to most nurses. We're all capable of that kind of thing.
Yep.
But thank you for sharing that story so we can all learn from your mistake and hopefully always trust but verify the kangaroo pump settings before you continue on with our shift. That's a good story. Okay, so before we close today, if you are precepting a new grad, are there any other pearls of wisdom or advice or things you don't want to forget when caring for this patient population?
Yeah. So to reiterate the importance of close neurologic assessments, close neurologic monitoring, anything that is a deviation or I always say moving the needle in the wrong direction from a neuro standpoint, the patient's GCS drops from a 14 to a 10. These are things to alert the physician for. And then you really, really want to tightly control these patients' lab values, sodium levels, volume status. So closely monitor their sodium levels. And you're going to, again, it's all from a trending standpoint. So if I sit down and get report or I look at my patient from the very first thing and I see a sodium level of 120, well, depends on where it came from is what's going to make a difference, whether I'm jumping on the phone to make a phone call or if I can just sit back and continue on with the rest of my assessment, whether that sodium level is going from a 115 to a 120 or from a 135 to a 120, right? So trending these lab values is really, really important. And then the other thing is understanding how sodium works and replacing it and being in close communication with your team, with the physician on where the sodium is at.
Nick, this was such a good patho breakdown. Thank you for joining me for this. If my listeners wanted to find you, where could they find more educational goodness from Nick McGowan?
So I have a website, ccrnacademy.com. I also have several social media sites. I'm trying to branch out and to meet every nurse at every level. So my main account is on my Instagram channel, critical_care_academy. Where I share daily tips and strategies and critical care knowledge, all things to help nurses who are studying for their CCRN exam. You can also find me on TikTok. I have a Facebook and a YouTube channel as well. So like I said, wherever you're at on your social media preference, I'm trying to have an account there and have a presence because I think education in an innovative way is very important, as you know.
Yes. And speaking of education, both of us will be at NTI in literally a month from now. I'm so excited. Ooh. So for those of you that are going to NTI, come check us out. Nick's going to be at booth 1424, and I'll be literally right next to him at booth 1425. Come say hi. Come take a picture. Come get some swag. We'd love to see you guys there. Nick, thank you again for your time today.
My pleasure.
Have a great rest of your week.
All right. You as well, Sarah. It's good seeing you.
Before you go, I just wanted to let you know that if you like this episode, you would probably like my course too. My 1-hour rapid response and rescue course is an introduction to how I approach emergencies. If you would like to learn to think, assess, and respond quickly when your patient is crashing, then you can check out my website, rapidresponseandrescue.com. And if you message me the word podcast on Instagram, I will send you a coupon code for $10 off the cost of the course. Oh, and did I mention that the course is approved by the AACN and worth one continuing education contact hour? So if you want to level up your emergency response skills and get one CE in the process, then this course is what you want. I put the link in the show notes for you. Well, thanks for listening. I hope you learned something that will save a life. Remember, nursing is a team sport, so trust your intuition and don't give up advocating until you are confident you've done what's right by your patient. The views and opinions expressed on this show are that of Sarah Lorenzini and hers alone. They are not intended as medical advice and should not take the place of your institution's policies or procedures. Evidence-based practice is ever-changing, and your patient care should reflect the current best practice. If you want to get in contact with Sarah, you can find her at rapidresponseandrescue.com or on social media platforms as TheRapidResponseRN.